Hello and welcome to the Inside Elland Road podcast. This is episode 91. I'm Graham Smith, chief football writer at the Yorkshire Evening Post, and I'm joined by Joe Urquhart, one of our Leeds United writers, to talk about all things Leeds United after their first Premier League game of the new season. The newly promoted Whites went to Anfield, probably the toughest game they possibly could have had in their opener, and lost 4-3 in a quite simply unbelievable game. Joe, it's been a while since we podcasted, but we'll gloss over that and simply talk about the football. Neither of us, of course, were actually at Anfield, sadly. Under the new COVID restrictions, it's only one journalist per organisation. And unfortunately, I was awaiting the result of a COVID test for one of my kids that didn't come in time. Thankfully, it has come now and it enabled me to go and watch Hull City. So really pleased about that. Neither of us were there, so we were watching it on Sky. As an occasion, and for you speaking as a Leeds fan, what were your feelings and emotions, firstly, at not being in the ground, and secondly, at Leeds being back in the Premier League?
I think it wouldn't have really made much of a difference without the fans there. I think that's where the sort of special occasion would have come from. You know, a packed out home end and a packed out away end would have really made that a special day to remember. But given the way the world at the moment, it's just not possible. So I think regardless of whether I was in the ground or not in terms of in the press box, I think it would have still been a very odd feeling to be there without supporters. On the second point, I think because I'm of a certain age, it all just felt very new. You know, it's been 16 years. Very vaguely remember Leeds United as a Premier League side, and the memories of a Premier League side are one that struggled a lot amid financial chaos. So to see Leeds United back playing at Anfield, obviously we had the cup game there a few years ago, but on the same footing as Liverpool and taking it to Jurgen Klopp and his Premier League champions was quite surreal, I think, at times, but very enjoyable and good signs to come, I think.
I worried for them when the penalty was awarded. I mean, firstly, let's touch on that. The ball ricocheted off Robin Koch's knee up onto his outstretched arm. It happened very quickly, so you can understand why the referee would have missed the deflection. Couldn't quite understand why VAR didn't check it properly, because the VAR check came back almost instantaneously and said, no, that's fine, carry on. When that penalty goes in, it's 1-0 after 3 minutes at Anfield. And at that stage, I could foresee a drubbing. You know, I could honestly see, and you know, that's me showing very little faith in the team. But let's remember who they're up against here. This is the best team in the Premier League, one of the very best teams in the world, with world-class players and a strike force that is frightening. And they're 1-0 up already. It was very possible that a lot of teams in that situation, Premier League teams included, would have folded and gone under.
How many times have we seen it where teams have gone to Anfield, conceded early, and then sort of capitulated under the pressure of playing and sort of getting worried, almost go the opposite way of going too far in, sort of playing within themselves, which causes them more issues. And I thought Leeds, you know, Bielsa summed it up before the game, didn't he? We'll stick to our methods no matter what. And he's really instilled that into his players. And that was a great quote, by the way. It's fantastic to see him on Sky. He always gives you one or two, doesn't he, that you just think, oh, brilliant. But I thought, you know, the response to the goal was great. The penalty was harsh. I think it's one of those where, because the referee's given it, VAR is not going to overrule it. I know that's quite a cynical way to look at it. But I think nowadays, I'm not even sure I understand the handball rules anymore. Basically, if it hits your hand, you're running the risk of a penalty no matter what now. So the best thing to do as a defender is to chop your arms off. That's how it seems like. It just feels a bit insane at the moment. But the second goal of the afternoon, the evening was phenomenal. And I think Liverpool, I've been introduced to the best first touch, not only in the Championship now, but in the Premier League. It was absolutely insane for Jack Harrison, wasn't it? It was just ridiculous. One touch, inside Trent Alexander-Arnold, who used to be the best fullback in the world, has been has been sent away now by Jackie Harrison.
Demoted.
But, yeah, sorry, pal. But yeah, it was that first goal was phenomenal. That ball from Phillips was just out of this world, wasn't it? The camera angle from behind the ball was just delightful. I'm not even sure how many times I've watched it back since, but it was ridiculous. And then obviously when they equalise, you're kind of going, well, this is anyone's game now, because Leeds are clearly not going to sit back. This could be a cricket score. It could be like 7-6. And to be honest, it wasn't really far wrong in the end, was it, at 4-3?
It was. The thing about that goal was that was just Leeds being Leeds. It was just Calvin Phillips looking up, seeing what he always sees, which is Jack Harrison flying away down the left and pinging a ball that we've seen him ping on numerous occasions. And Jack Harrison showcasing a first touch that we've seen so many times. I mean, it was special. You know, let's not make any bones about it. The touch to beat Trent Alexander-Arnold and then the touch to take it on and then the touch to get to the edge of the area. It was all superb. Great finish as well. Really clinical. But it was just really all very familiar. And I almost wonder if Leeds realised in that moment, if we play the way we play, we can hurt Liverpool at Anfield. And that maybe gave them the confidence and freedom to go on and play some of the attacking football they did. Because it actually worked. You know, this football that worked in the Championship, and you know, they come into this game knowing we were the best team in the Championship. As Stuart Dallas said, it remained to be seen how he could do it in the Premier League. It remained to be seen how Leeds can do in the Premier League, and that's still the case. But the first real attempt at playing Bielsa ball brought them a goal at Anfield against the Champions, against an unbelievable defence. And then, you know, as the game swings wildly back and forth, it goes to 2-1. You maybe wonder, oh, is that it? Have they had their moment? And then Van Dijk coughs up the ball. And Patrick Bamford, how important was it for him to stick that away, having missed an earlier chance? And you could just hear it starting up, you know, the Bamford narrative that we get constantly. You could hear, you know, people calling for Rodrigo to come on straight away. And then he gets a second chance and tucks it home on his right foot. That must have felt incredible for him.
Absolutely. Van Dijk papping his pants in the presence of Patrick Bamford was not something that I thought I was going to see on Saturday, but it was a very clinical finish. And it's one of those where he's probably not had much time to think about it. He's just sort of put it in the area and he's got it past the goalkeeper. And a lot of the times, once you do that, you're going to score. I thought Liverpool were, I'm not sure if it's fair to say naive, but I don't think a lot of teams will have, especially in the past 2 or 3 years, gone to Anfield and sort of taken the game to them like that, other than, you know, the top teams, Man City, Arsenal, possibly Man U, but maybe not Man U. But, you know, and Bayern Munich, Barcelona, teams like that, I can't imagine that a lot of A, newly promoted sides, but then B, you know, basically the bottom half of the Premier League have gone to Anfield and quite exposed themselves that much, you know.
Pardon?
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought when I was saying that, I thought, should I say this? But you know what I mean? Like pushing so many men forward. I mean, you could hear it in the voice of like Jamie Carragher and people who were watching on. They were like, I don't know if they hadn't done their research, but maybe because it was the first time they were seeing it in the flesh, they were just surprised at how committed they are to the front press, to committing players forward beyond the front line, supporting Bamford. And that's what Bielsa brings, his total commitment and belief to his footballing style. And anyone who thought they were ever going to play any differently was stupid. And I think it probably, you know, the way that they played was obviously very admirable. They obviously didn't get anything out of the game. They all cliche, they won a lot of hearts. But if you've watched Bielsa over the last 2 years, that's exactly how Leeds United play. And it should have been no surprise to anyone, really. It's just maybe that they're doing it to a wider audience now.
Bielsa said it before the game on his interview with Sky with his brand new translator, whose name we still don't have. He tested him as well, didn't he? He's in his first couple of press conferences, Bielsa's he's tested the mettle of the new man with, in fact, the very first answer in the pre-game press conference, Bielsa questioned whether he'd accurately translated everything Bielsa had said, and he had. But the kid was unflappable. He just, you know, he faced up to the boss and said, no, I did. And then... and after the game on Sky, when he was translating Bielsa, and Bielsa chided him to speak up and project his voice, you know, to the interviewer, I thought he's coaching him. You know, he's actually coaching his translator, which is phenomenal to see. But the new guy's done a great job, I think, so far. But when they had that interview before the game on Sky, Bielsa said, "We're not going to lie down for anyone, and this isn't a vanity thing. It's just a belief in the style of football." And that's exactly what Leeds showed. Click's goal was superb. I mean, Liverpool 3-2 up, you go into the second half, gets to an hour mark, and you think Liverpool are starting to look a little bit more in control here. And just when you think that, Leeds press high up the pitch from a Liverpool throw-in, they win the ball back. Click sprays it to the right to Costa, and then makes this superb blindside run, just darts into the box. Nobody picks him up. Costa picks him out. One touch, volley, goal. It was so good that I could almost scarcely believe it had happened. It was just perfect. Like, it was a perfect goal for the whole thing, from winning the ball so high up the pitch, as Bielsa likes to do, because the further you win it from your goal, the less chance there is of you conceding, and the more chance of you scoring. And then just to move the ball so quickly, and for the pieces to all fall into place the way it did in the finish, it was, it's already a contender, I think, for Leeds' goal of the season, and we're one game in.
What about the first one, though? That's got to be there as well, hasn't it? That's the problem.
I mean, it's a nice problem, but you're right, it is a problem. We've probably got to set our bar very, very high this season for goal this season. Because remember last season, there were some lovely goals, and then Luke Ayling did something that no right back really has a right to do. So maybe we should just hold fast on the goal of the season just yet, and just say that those were nice examples of Leeds United goals.
The bar has been set. They now can't score any other goals other than the set of the same standard. I think, to be fair, we have got, 37 games left of the season, so there probably will be a few more. Well, hopefully there will be a few more.
Well, there better be a few more.
About the defensive partnership, shouldn't we, really? Given that...
Yes, we've talked about the highs.
Given that they met each other on, Tuesday or Wednesday, depending on flights back from international duty, and then probably found out they were playing together on Friday night. And to be fair, for chunks of the first half, they did look like they had literally met each other a couple of days before, but I think when you're going up against one of the best attacks in European football, I thought in the second half they recovered really well and did a pretty good job, really.
Well, let's talk about the defence then. So Liam Cooper pulls out with a calf issue, picked up on international duty. Nice one, Scotland. And Pascal Struijk with his 5 previous senior appearances in league action, 3 of which came in Calvin Phillips' midfield role. He steps in to play alongside a defender who first linked up with the squad a few days before, like you said, after his own international ventures with Germany. It's not an ideal start to any season, never mind a Premier League season, never mind when you're going up against Salah and Mane. And yes, you're right, there were times when it looked disorganised, but it was disorganised. They didn't have the preparation time. They don't have a partnership to speak of. So that was always going to be the case. I felt Koch got a little bit unlucky with Van Dijk's header. He did get slightly impeded, not intentionally. There was no foul, but he did get blocked up. Whether or not he would have affected the run or managed to get in front of the ball, I'm not too sure. But there was a little bit of misfortune there. It was really set pieces where they looked the ropiest. You know, Salah's goal where he picked out the top corner with that unbelievable finish. That was from a free kick pumped long into the box, and Struyck won the first header really well. Unfortunately, he backheaded it straight to the man you really don't want to head it to, and Salah stuck it in. And it just seemed like at free kicks and corners, they didn't really get to grips with Liverpool's movement or Van Dijk at all. You know, he put the ball in the net again, had it disallowed because Cock was impeded again this time. There was intent behind it, so Leeds got a free kick. But other than that, I honestly don't think it was too bad defensively. Like, I think Stuart Dallas, whilst having a very hard time with Salah, and Salah scored a hat-trick, I thought Dallas defended pretty well. You know, he made so many tackles. And then when he had the ball, some of his link-up play to get Leeds out of Liverpool's press was superb. I thought Struyck started nervously, almost scored a wonder goal in his own net, but settled really well. And Bielsa felt he was one of the better players in the team. Showed some of his passing range as well, which was nice. And Koch had a difficult debut. And Ayling, I thought, was superb against Mane. Really, really good. Got a nutmeg in there. I think it finished 1-1 on nutmegs. And he got a flop in as well, which ticked another box. But Meslier did pretty well too. You know, maybe should have stopped the header from Van Dijk, but other than that, made a few good saves, and his distribution was really good, contributed to Leeds playing out from the back. So, all in all, pretty satisfactory. You know, people will say, oh, it's worrying that they didn't defend the set pieces, and it was worrying that they looked so disorganised. That's going to improve naturally the more time they have together, the more games they get. And of course, Cooper's going to come back in pretty soon. And give them a bit more experience and a bit more nous. So the more time that he and Robin Koch spend together, the better. And that disorganisation will probably disappear as a natural effect.
It's probably a symptom as well of the fact that you literally take out two players of the four who were the best defence in the Championship and for a long time in Europe last year. And it's not like the set piece issue is a new thing, to be honest. There was a lot of the Championship season last year where corners, they always looked quite susceptible, maybe whether it was due to height or due to organisation. There were times in a Championship where they got bullied at corners. But yeah, I think when you take out Ben White and Liam Cooper and put two new centre-halves into a back four that has performed so well under Bielsa for the last 2 years, you're always going to be some teething problems. And then, like you said earlier, chucking the fact that you're going to one of the best attacks in European football. All right, they conceded four goals, but it's not like they weren't holding firm in the second half. There were signs there. There was a moment where I think Koch battled out Mane in the second half, took it wide, and then sort of found a man further forward. And you can see why he fits the sort of Ben White mould and why Leeds have been tracking him for so long. So it's just one of those. I think also it was probably just one of those games that sometimes you just write off as it's crazy that football throws up. You know, the way that the early goal sets off a chain of events that sort of all bets are off, 4-3. I don't think anyone would have had that down as the opening day result when Salah scored that penalty and his second goal. I think in the Championship you can probably get away with a little bit of a loose header like that, but when you take the jumping class to the Premier League, his first touch was unreal. So we go with the bottom of his boot to set it up so that he put it in literally the only place he could score, because everyone to the left of him was a horde of bodies in front of the goal, and Meslier was in the middle. So like that was literally the only gap he could have found to score. And that's the gulf in class when you maybe jump up into the division that your mistakes maybe get punished a little bit more. So yeah, just a few things to learn and improve on. But as we know, going there and giving the fight to Liverpool can only give them confidence. And like you say, they're only going to improve with time on the training pitch as a back four and a defensive unit.
Well, you know, you had it right. You talk about crazy games. Look at Birmingham last season and 5-4. You know, Leeds were so good at keeping clean sheets and so good at keeping teams out last year, and yet went to Birmingham and had a defensive mare, but just about got away with it. Bielsa himself said that, you know, if he had one conclusion to take, it was that errors at this level equal goals. Rodrigo, unfortunate moment for him, makes his debut on 66 minutes, comes on, runs about a bit, contributes to the press, doesn't really get involved too much in the offensive play because Liverpool were on the front foot. He did make a nice run when Costa played the ball into Click, however. In fact, some of the... I tell you what, the window cleaner's just given me a heart attack. I've just looked out the window and saw this, and I'm on the second floor and saw this object waving past the window, and it's one of those telescopic... Anyway.
I feel like we're getting a bit off subject. You were talking about Rodrigo.
I was talking about Rodrigo. his challenge in the area was clumsy. It was just very, very clumsy. He left a leg out. What he was trying to do, I'm not so sure, but he's made his apology on social media, at least. Bielsa didn't hold him culpable for the result because Liverpool could have scored from other situations. And it's a lesson learned. And it maybe just dampens down the kind of rampant expectations over him, at least. You know, record signing, everyone expecting him to tear up the Premier League. It maybe just... That and Bamford's goal maybe just calms everything down a bit and will help people to be patient as Rodrigo learns the system and adapts, and as Bamford continues to do what he's been doing under Bielsa. It was unfortunate. I felt for him.
Can I ask what you gave him player rating-wise?
I gave him a 6.
No, I just wonder because as debuts go, it wasn't exactly the best.
No, it wasn't. And
for a club record signing. And to be fair, a difficult game to come on, let's be honest, when it's all frantic like that. But it was just a clumsy and one of those that you categorise as a striker's challenge, unfortunately. Just a flailing. It was almost like a half attempt, wasn't it? Like a jump and challenge, and he just caught him. But a bit frustrating. I think there'll be lots to come. And like we say, there's... Can't say the one thing about Cock is that he didn't have much time to prepare, and then say the same about Rodrigo because he was with Spain as well. So just a shame that happened.
Yeah, I gave him a 6, but I probably should have given him a 5. I think I was caught up in the, that was really good, as I did the player ratings, because you do them straight after a game. It's a first take. But not having considered it, if I was to do a revised set of player ratings, then I think Costa would possibly go to a 7.5 from 7. Rodrigo would go to a 5. Pablo Hernandez, I think I gave him a 6. I might consider a 5.5 for Pablo because I really don't think he was as in the game or as effective. Well, he was nowhere near as effective as he can be. We know that. I did see some tweets from people saying things like, we need a new number 10. It's one game. One game, Joe. You cannot write off a player of Pablo Hernandez's ability and skill after one game of the new season. You can't conclude anything after one game.
No, you can't. And I think because of the way that Bielsa managed him last year, all right, albeit with an injury, fans have probably seen that perhaps that could be the best way of using him going forward this year, bringing him on when other people are tiring a bit more for that little bit of quality. I mean, there was a few moments of real class where he delivered in the final third, but we've talked about it loads, but it was one of those games where I think it's quite difficult to sort of get to grips with. Bamford even said it in his post-match that after sort of 25, 30 minutes, he was catching his breath because he was just a bit confused about what was going on around him. He sort of felt like he was just running around like a headless chicken trying to chase the ball, which a lot of the time that is Bielsa ball. But, you know, it was one of those frantic games where as Leeds equalised, Liverpool 2 minutes later before Leeds have even got their bearings had gone back ahead. So there was one moment for Pablo, though, where I can't remember who it was. I think it might have been Robertson or someone else tried to nutmeg him. I don't know if you remember that. And he closed his legs and went, no, that's not me. I do like you. that was a classic Pablo moment. But plenty to improve on for everyone, I think.
Yeah. The reaction afterwards was largely, what a game. Fantastic. Lots of people saying nice things about Marcelo Bielsa. It's funny, one of the Squareball fanzine guys, Emo, last year after they played Arsenal said that it was like your favourite band going mainstream, and suddenly everybody liked them. And it's going to feel a bit like that this season. There is going to be a lot of people saying things about Marcelo Bielsa as if they're brand new discoveries that Leeds fans have known for the guts of 2 years. Stuff that's already been discussed at local level that's going to be some pundit's great revelation. There's also going to be things said about Marcelo Bielsa and Leeds that aren't true because they get a reaction and clicks. But yeah, I wrote a piece for our supplement, I think it was our 19th supplement of the summer, in the YEP last weekend, saying that there will be some willful misunderstanding of Bielsa and his ways, because Leeds brings a lot of clicks and a lot of reaction, a lot of engagement online. It really didn't take very long, did it? You know, it staggers me that there were actual journalists and people involved in the industry bringing up the English thing and saying, well, he really should be speaking English after the first game of the Premier League season. He's been here for 2 years. He's done every single interview for 2 years in Spanish with a translator. Why now is it an issue? I mean, it's very, very lazy for a start, because it assumes that Bielsa is somehow, or it casts aspersions that he's somehow disrespecting England and English culture or the English game, or that he's, you know, somehow whiling away his time in Wetherby away from the football, watching Netflix or playing Football Manager. All Marcelo Bielsa does is work. He just works on football. He just analyzes and watches and studies and thinks and plans. So it's no surprise, really, that he hasn't found the time to learn English to a suitable standard that he would be happy getting his message across to the press and, I guess, to his players. But we also know that he speaks enough English that he won the championship by a country mile last season, and it was not a problem at any stage for his players. So for people to start bringing it up now, it's going to come up periodically throughout the season as various red-faced pundits and hacks decide that this is their moment to bring it up because they fancy a bit of attention. It's very, very frustrating for Leeds fans, but this is where I think their patience is going to be. It's one of the areas where their patience is really going to be tested.
I felt like I'd woken up in like August 2018 on Sunday morning, looking at some of the tweets from some very odd people on Twitter, just talking about is the fact that he doesn't speak English. It's almost like they've watched the game the night before and they can't find much to criticise him, so they'll just fall back on the fact that he's not bothered to learn English. It just doesn't make any sense. There is nothing to it. Like you say, if it was such, the only argument that could be made for it is if it was an issue for the players. And over the past 2 years, it has absolutely been proven that it is not an issue for the players. It just doesn't make any sense. It's a pathetic argument. It's stupid. And to be honest, it's pathetic. And it feels a little bit, you know, agenda-driven from certain individuals. We won't name them. But it's just, you know, it maybe comes back to the fact that there's some underlying Leeds United issues there for people that they need to work through with a therapist or something, because it's just ridiculous. It's not even a thing. People just need to shut up about it and move on.
And I'll tell you what else will probably test the patience of Leeds fans a little bit, potentially, is opposition managers saying nice things about Leeds was great last season when Leeds were winning. You know, every time an opposition manager waxed lyrical about Leeds and their players being machines and Bielsa's style of football and everything, it was really nice for Leeds fans to hear, and they lapped it up. If they're not winning games, that will get tiresome very quickly. Nobody wants. I remember which manager it was at Chesterfield saying that whenever they lost and an opposition manager said, you know, how well they played and they deserve to be higher up the table and they'd be fine if they played like that, it made his blood boil, because they'd lost the game and it was completely irrelevant and patronising, I guess. Leeds kind of they will get a lot of credit for playing the way they play, and they're not going to change their style this season. On the evidence of Saturday Anfield, there can be a lot of confidence that Leeds are going to do well in a lot of games. But there is the potential that when they're not winning, because they're not going to win every week, and managers talk nicely about them, or people talk about the nice style of play, I think we're going to see a lot on Twitter of, yeah, but we lost. Or, yeah, but the most important stat is the scoreline. Whenever you talk about possession, or you talk about chances created, or if we ever dare to talk about expected goals. I think that there's still going to be an element in the Leeds fan base that doesn't want to hear nice things unless the result has been positive.
Yeah, I think that's natural. I also think it probably depends who's saying it and what team they've played. So, like, for example, Jurgen Klopp praising them in a battling defeat is a bit different to say that they get beat by Fulham at the weekend and Scott Parker comes out and goes, bloody hell, they're good, isn't it? You know, that's no disrespect to Scott Parker, but it's sort of the way of the world that the quality of the opposition as well probably dictates a little bit the feeling of from supporters. Because you'd say it's obvious to state, but a good performance at Liverpool now has to be backed up with a couple of good performances and results against teams that they need to be beating to ultimately first stay in this division, and then second start looking upwards against Fulham and Sheffield United before you then play Manchester City, where it's just going to be a Guardiola Bielsa loving, isn't it? So I think there was lots of positives, but I think the focus on the opposition manager will probably be dictated by the quality of the opposition a lot of the time.
Yeah, that Fulham game is really quite big, because you don't want your first win to take too long, because you don't want it to become a thing. You don't want it to become 3, 4 or more games without a win, because then all of a sudden, you know, a narrative starts to build and hysteria starts to build, and there'll be a, you know, Leeds aren't doing it in the Prem. You know, they might be playing nice stuff, but they can't win in the Prem. And the Fulham game presents a real opportunity, you know, to go out and beat a team that Leeds know they're fully capable of beating, if they play well and if they work hard. And getting that first win in the second game would be massive, you know, 3 points on the board out of a possible 6, because the Liverpool game was almost a write-off anyway. No one really expected Leeds to win that game. But everyone will expect Leeds to beat Fulham, I think just about everyone. Before that, though, we have a rare treat indeed. We have some nostalgia in the form of a fixture against a Championship side. Remember the Championship?
Not a Championship side, though, are they?
Of course they're not, no.
They're a League One side, which is even worse.
They're a League One side, but they were, of course, part of Leeds United's fixture list the last time Leeds played in the Championship all the way
back. Good save.
In last season. It's a game in the Carabao Cup.
Carabao? Can we just
sweet taste of Carabao?
What is how long has it been the sponsor? I'm not even still not sure I know what Carabao is.
It's an energy drink.
Is it?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know if we can go into a product review without having the podcast checked by JPI Media's solicitors. So we'll move along. Let's just say it's not in my fridge. That's what we'll say about that energy drink. So this game,
other energy drinks are available.
Yeah, and no, I'm not going to say that. It's the Carabao Cup. It's the second round. It's not on Sky. It's on CarabaoLive.com. I hope and pray that they have invested in an enormous server or whatever it is that it needs to ensure that there are no iFollow style issues when Leeds fans pay their tenner in their droves to watch this game.
It's all right. The server will be powered by Carabao. So no hiccups here.
High octane server.
Can you foresee any hiccups with this issue? I don't really. I mean, it's just the way the world at the moment, isn't it? That you just said 12 months ago, you'd be sat streaming a first round Carabao Cup fixture on CarabaoLive.com when no fans in. It's an odd set of circumstances, but obviously a chance, hopefully, for Leeds United to maybe have another game where they can get a bit more coherent defensively, but also potentially test out some fringe players as well. Obviously, with the 23s on Monday night, there was maybe a bit of a hint over players that could potentially be involved, the likes of sort of Leif Davis, Ollie Casey, maybe even Cresswell, depending. I mean, it'll be interesting to see if he's involved prominently, to be honest, because he, with the under-23s, he didn't play any recognised centre-halves, so it kind of implies that maybe he'll be involved on Wednesday night. So, interesting to see, because obviously Gelhard, Greenwood and Dramy all made their debuts, so you wouldn't expect them to be involved unless they, potentially get a spot on the bench. But interesting to see how Bielsa approaches it from a point of view, because he was really, last year, he was really annoyed to go out of the cup because it is an extra game for the squad to utilise in a competitive environment away from his sort of world-renowned murder ball sessions. So it will be interesting. There's absolutely no doubt he'll want to go through, but at the same time, he needs to sort of get that competitive environment game time for those who he wants to involve in his squad this year.
Yeah, that game, it's funny, because this cup, a cup run would be really nice. Let's be honest, it would be nice to have a decent cup run. And last year in this competition, when they played Stoke in that game and they went 2-0 down and he made three changes at the break and they came back and equalised. And it was Eddie Nketiah, wasn't it, tucked in the equaliser. I think, did Costa score in that game as well? I think Costa might have got a header. And I think Eddie Nketiah might have scored in like the 89th minute or whatever. And Elland went absolutely bonkers.
Your memory is a lot better than mine. The only thing I remember is Ben White came on at half-time and that was the only 45 minutes of the season he didn't play. And Jack Harrison missed the penalty that cost them.
They'd just beaten Stoke 3-0 in the league and then they hosted a very strong and experienced Stoke side at Elland Road. And if memory serves...
McCallum played, didn't he? Oh, sorry.
He did. He played the first 45. If memory serves, at halftime, Ben White, Forshaw and Harrison came on for McCallum, Shackleton and Clark. And then if I remember correctly, it was the 67th minute when Eddie Nketiah scored.
I feel like you're reading this off a sheet now.
And then in the 81st minute, Helder Costa popped up with a header to equalise and Elland Road went crazy. And then they lost on pens, didn't they? Eddie, I remember that goal, and Nketiah's goal. And I'm not reading this now, but I was reading that, but I'm not reading this. It was when Jack Butland played the ball out off one of his own defender's backsides, and Nketiah took it, ran through, and slid it round him. Not remember?
I've completely erased this from my memory. I don't remember that at all.
You were wearing your black hoodie. Does that jog your memory? Anyway.
Where was it? Was it Elland Road?
It was Elland Road, yeah, because Marcelo was very, very annoyed after the game. Because it was obvious that he saw this competition as a chance to give match minutes to players who needed it. And they went out, having beaten Salford in the first...
That's right. Yeah, because they went to Salford. You were on holiday. And
correct.
I had to sit in the stand. I didn't even get a press seat.
Yeah.
Sit with the laptop surrounded by Salford fans. That was an interesting experience. And because Phil the Haymaker Hay went in the away end, didn't he? Bless him, with his flares.
Smoke bombs or trousers?
Both, I think. Well, he did that. I don't think the Athletic got one in, so I think he just decided to go in the away end, which is very Phil. Bless him.
Yeah. So it will be interesting to see what kind of team he puts out this time around. I think Rodrigo might get a start. You know what I'd love? We'll talk about the 23s kind of now, but I'd love to see Gelhard on the bench. I know he played last night, but I'd love to see him get a few minutes with the first team just to see if the strength and skill he showed against Stoke's under-23s translates to first team football. And I know they're going to be patient with him and they're going to build him up over time and he's going to play a lot of murder ball and he's going to play a lot of 23s games. But he looked... You know the difference between, like, the 18s went to Accrington Stanley and got bullied. They stood up and they kept going, but there were times when they got physically bullied and beaten in the air and dominated. Whereas Gelhardt has the look of, it's like he has man strength already. He's a young man, but he is, you know, the comparisons to Rooney are there for a reason, because he's got that strength that kind of you don't expect a youngster of that age to have. And he rolls defenders off and he knocks them out the way and he shields the ball really well. Of that 23's kind of set of performances in the 4-0 defeat, his was the pick of the bunch for me.
Yeah, I agree. Got a bit of criticism for saying he was the real deal last night, but not, I didn't mean it as in like he's the real deal ready for the Premier League. I meant that he looks what we've been told about from Wigan coaches, from clips we've seen of him playing in the Championship, that he is probably a cut above, it looks like, the 23s. Whether that doesn't necessarily mean he's Premier League football ready, but he looks very much a very bright talent and someone...
He's Football League ready.
Yeah. Well, I think you could say that from his involvement with Wigan last year. So it'll be interesting to see how his development goes and how his involvement under Bielsa transpires this season, because he's obviously already played a lot of games for Wigan, hasn't started too many, but has got a goal at the Championship level, has shown glimpses, and we referenced it last night, but he gets the ball and he, you know, when he starts running at players, he doesn't look super quick, but he sort of just glides past them. You know, he's got that little knack of when a player lunges in at him, he sort of shifts the ball out of his feet. You know, the ball's never far enough away from too far enough away from him to sort of keep it under his control, etc., etc. So interesting, not trying to hype him up too much, but it's just an interesting acquisition, because for £1 million, if that's potential you've got, it looks like a very good little addition for Leeds and someone that they'll, I'm sure, be working on very hard behind the scenes.
The 23s will be interesting to watch this season, because there are players in there. Well, there's players in that squad who have been eyeing loans and are desperate to get out on loan. Alfie McAlmont made it very clear when he signed his new deal he wanted to go out on loan. I think Robbie Gotts is keen on a loan, and that's been kind of talked about, and it was on the table at one stage for Huddersfield, it looked like, and then it's kind of disappeared from the table again. Jordan Stevens looks like he'll be going out to Swindon Town. Good move. You know, any move to a Football League side, well, not any move, because there's some awful teams and awful managers in the Football League, but a move to play men's football is a good move for anyone who's kind of had their fill of 23s games. And I know it's not particularly the Bielsa way to let players go out on loan if they're part of his plans, but I honestly think the move to Aberdeen will do Ryan Edmondson the world of good. I mean, firstly, it gets him out of this kind of bubble where I guess he's quite well known, you know, like in and around it's Harrogate, isn't it, where he's based. And he's had a kind of a lot of profile and a lot of plaudits for his goal record at under 18s and under 23s at a very young age. He almost needs to go out and get away from that and be a bit of an unknown with something to prove somewhere else in a men's first team competitive environment. And I think the move to Aberdeen is a good one for him. Be very, very, very keen to see how he gets on now that he's not quite as injured as Aberdeen thought. Aberdeen initially diagnosed the injury as a really bad one. He came back, Leeds had a look and said, actually, no, it's not really that bad at all. It's more of a six-weeker. So he's gone back up and he was hoping to have some involvement this week in the Europa League, which is possibly a little bit soon for him. But young footballers just want to play football, don't they? Boys just want to have fun. So he's one to keep an eye on. There are others as well. You know, Bryce Hosanna, you wonder if he might potentially look at getting a loan. But for the rest and for the new boys under Mark Jackson, the 23s will be very interesting this season. What do you make of the appointment of Jackson and the recruitment for the 23s?
Well, I think the recruitment on the face of it looks very good. They've gone for some high quality individuals, paid hefty amounts of money for players, but have brought in players that fit the mould that they're going for, the style of football they're trying to play. And it feels like they've got the quality over quantity. It's really not long ago since the 23s were literally getting players through the door just to fill out a squad to compete in the second tier of the academy, and now they're in the Category 1 status, using it as a feeder club to Marcelo Bielsa. So it's been a very swift turnaround. I think Mark Jackson's, I think it's quite a shrewd appointment, really, for everything you've just outlined, because of the way that he's worked with the under-18s. He's just sort of come through the young age group since he joined the club as a coach. But I think with what you're talking about, loan deals for a lot of the sort of more advanced under-23s players, there's going to be a fair bit of reliance on the under-18s in this season. I think when we start to see loan moves sort of materialise in the next few weeks. So I think bedding in a lot of the under-18s players into the under-23s with these new signings to sort of play the style of play, learn the trade, and ultimately help the young players develop, but help the new arrivals adjust to their sort of new surrounds and the demands of what's required at Leeds United. I think it's he's a good coach. Anytime you speak to any of the players, I remember interviewing Jamie Shackleton a few years ago after they won the national title, and he referenced Mark without him being prompted about the way that he helped bring him through. Robbie got similar. So I think he's got quite a high stock at Thorpe Arch, and I think it probably shows that it's a good chance for him to go in there. It's a bit more exposure, and with it comes a little bit more pressure. Obviously, the under-23s isn't all results-driven. It's about developing in a learning environment, but at the same time, you know, they will want to try and have a little bit of success now that they are a Category 1 academy. So I think it's a shrewd appointment, going back to the original point, and I wish him all the best with it.
Yeah, obviously they brought in some new faces for him to work with, and highly rated youngsters as well. Cody Drama, for whom there was no drama, despite a lot of excitement on social media. He was in the game last night. Greenwood, the two-footed striker from Arsenal. And Charlie Allen was in the squad last night as well, who is one to keep an eye on. David Healy raved about him and his attitude, I think, more than anything. You know, he does seem to have quite a bit of ability, and they're very excited about him in Northern Ireland. So it'll be interesting to see when he gets into the 23s.
Stuart McKinstry is always someone who impresses me for his age, but also always someone who people talk about very highly. So I'm interested to see how he does play more consistently in the 23s this year, because he played last night, obviously wasn't maybe as involved as he would have liked to have been, but he's someone who I think coming from, was it Motherwell, I think, last year, he's someone who I think a lot of people in the Scottish sort of youth national setup have a lot of high hopes for as well, probably similarly to Charlie Allen. So it'll be a little bit older than Charlie Allen, but it'll be interesting to see how he goes this year as well. Obviously, Liam McCarron, another who's probably going to stick around, you'd imagine. So there's lots to be interested in, I think, at the development level this year. And like you say, with Mark Jackson, he's going to have a job of melding the new arrivals with some of the existing and then some of the under-18s. And it's, I think he's probably the perfect candidate they've got within Thorpe Arch, who knows the players inside out, to sort of do that management job of sort of merging the two squads and managing that transition with a lot of the players.
And of course, he'll probably, from time to time, have people like Pascal Struick or first-team players, you know, getting minutes and keeping their fitness up. So it is, as Paul Hart said in today's YEP, the trickiest job at Leeds United. But Hart felt he's more than deserving of the role, Mark Jackson. So let's talk then briefly about the news that came out morning that this is the week when Amazon Prime will show season 2 of Take Me Home. It's a two-parter this time. It'll be very interesting to see how they deal with it, because last season the documentary makers weren't there for part of the season when it wasn't so certain that they were going to be doing a documentary, and then they reappeared towards the second half of the season. It'd be very interesting to see what behind the scenes stuff they captured and what the focus is on. I mean, Jonathan Liu did a fantastic piece in the New Statesman this week about Tottenham's glossy advert, and how, you know, it's not really warts and all, you know, not really. There was a lot of like behind the scenes stuff from Tottenham that you maybe wouldn't have expected to see, like some of Mourinho's conversations with players. But you know what you would really, really want from a Leeds United documentary is Bielsa at Brentford, you know, speaking to the players and giving them that team talk that had them standing on their chairs in the "Oh, captain, my captain" moment. Stuff like that. Stuff like, you know, the conversations that were had around the time when it became apparent that Jean-Kevin Augustin was not going to feature. I'd love to see stuff like that. I suspect it'll, and it, there's a real case to be made that, yes, it should focus on the players who actually made it happen and give an insight into their state of mind, and how they'll do it in just two episodes is going to be interesting as well. So it's a wait and see. A watching brief comes out this week. Any moments that you'd really like to see in there that you would have loved to have been there for?
I think if you're talking about the psychology of the season, the reaction in the dressing room to the Nottingham Forest defeat, I think having a camera in there post-match to see what the players were like. When you're talking about this sort of, when you look and reflect back on the season as a whole, because that was a big moment when Luke Ayling came out after and did that interview. And then obviously they went to Brentford 4 days later, put in a strong performance and sort of kicked on from there. But I feel like having like sort of been able to see the reaction to that result and just how downbeat they were, how dejected, whether anyone was in there sort of trying to pick them up or whether they were sort of just left to sit quietly by their dressing room pegs. It would be an interesting watch that, but unfortunately I don't think we'll probably get any of that stuff. And I think, like you've just referenced there, a lot of these documentaries tend to be a bit promotional, kind of leave you feeling quite happy about everything, but maybe leave you wanting a little bit more. It's always, obviously it'll be great to see footage of the celebrations and things like that for the players on the night they were promoted and on the pitch, as we've seen in the trailer. But yeah, it'll be, we just have to wait and see to see how it deals with lots of different subjects over the season, I guess. The coronavirus stuff as well. You know, it'll be interesting to see how much we get of Rob Price and his medical team sort of preparations for, because they seem to be ahead of a lot of other people in terms of, you know, spotting it early in January, getting players sorted, how they dealt with that, the mentality of the squad when the season came to a halt, everything like that. But it's very difficult to know how they're going to delve into these subjects in just 2 45-minute episodes. So I guess we'll wait and see.
You're mostly desperate to see if your little face makes it in again, aren't you?
I wasn't even in the first one. I think you saw the back of my head at the Spike conference, and that was it. I told my mum about it and everything. Yeah. I don't think there'll be a lot of press conference stuff, will there, this year? They didn't seem to be there. And last year, there was obviously, they managed to finally get Bielsa at the end of the season doing a bit of a sit down. And that sort of felt like it came from a place where Bielsa felt like he was committed to the club again. And wanted to sort of get something out there on record to say that he, you know, I think the quote that Leeds fans hung off a lot this year while his contract saga was going on was that he said, "I'm proud to be involved with an institution like this." And that is, you know, such a great quote. But that little interview at the end with Bielsa was sort of the little magic that you sit in those little things for. And obviously the Kinnear quote, everyone knows that. So hopefully there's none of that. We're not dicking around with relegation job in this one.
Yeah, I'm not sure he'd say that again, given a second chance. You mentioned the word saga there. Let's talk about Rodrigo De Paul, Rodrigo the Troll. So last night, the square ball quite politely sent a very warm and friendly message to Rodrigo De Paul of Udinese, that midfielder that Leeds have had their eye on, who would be an absolute game changer. Let's be honest, very, very, very talented footballer. And they sent him a tweet just wishing him a nice evening, really. And then when somebody asked, you know, what the latest was with it, and the square ball put forward the suggestion that they were, you know, they were just waiting for the two clubs to sort it out, the player himself then quite unexpectedly, replied with a yes and a fingers crossed emoji, which, of course, if the intention was to break Leeds Twitter in half, then it had the desired effect. And then he deleted the tweet and then disappeared from Twitter, because I'm guessing that roughly 120 seconds after he tweeted that, his phone rang, and it was either his agent or his football club telling him to stop being so silly. But it went down well in West Yorkshire, because it essentially said, here I am, I really quite like this move, make it happen. It's not quite a transfer request, but it was a moment, wasn't it?
I'm just trying to think of the reaction from Leeds fans if it was the other way around.
Calvin Phillips, when Villa looked at him, for
yeah,
instance.
So like obviously it wouldn't quite be the same because Calvin Phillips is homegrown. Obviously, DePaul's not like Udinese through and through, but he's still one of their best players. He's a £40 million rated player. And he's sat on Twitter liking tweets and then unliking them and then responding to opposition fanzines. I'd actually quite like to join your football club. I'm just trying to think the rage that would ensue on Leeds United Twitter if that was
a player would be done. I mean, that would be...
Yeah,
as far as the fan base are concerned, that would be it.
So, obviously, it'll be interesting to see and hear Udinese... Firstly, the football club's thoughts on that, and then obviously supporters, because that is—he's basically saying that he's done with the football club. He's not going to be there. So whether it's Leeds United or somewhere else, you don't imagine, unless it's a very, very awkward grovelling conversation that he has to have after the transfer window shuts and the move doesn't materialise, that he'll still be there, because that's sort of a point of no return for me. It was completely unprompted. It wasn't like he was caught off guard in an interview. You know, post pre-season friendly or something like that. He was just sat scrolling Twitter and responded and knew full well what he was doing. So interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the latest is that, you know, a bid hasn't actually been submitted for the player. There have been conversations, and the price does appear to be a sticking point. I mean, fantastic footballer, yes, would be a game changer, would be another record-breaking deal, and he would have an impact, and he could play, you know, roles, different roles for Bielsa. He's got a lot of attributes that you think would be very effective, even in the Premier League with a new team. But also, he's a bit of a loose cannon with his phone in his hand, and does that fit with a dressing room that we know is... They don't let stuff slip on. So they might do the odd bit of trolling of opposition teams, or you know, Matthias Klick sometimes has a bit of fun on social media, but you never see anything that you think, oh, the club are definitely going to tell him to delete that. You know, we haven't seen any of that from the Leeds United dressing room. We know that Liam Cooper runs a pretty tight ship, and that he's got other experienced generals around him, like Dallas and Ayling, who are leaders, and they keep the young lads in check. And they have, on occasion, brought youngsters into line when they were acting out a little bit, or their behaviour maybe fell short of the culture that's been set. I wonder how a player like that, who's made those kind of decisions on social media, fits with that kind of ethos. Because as Raj Razani said, they have to be very careful to get the right kind of characters in.
Yeah, and we saw similar social media in from Augustine, didn't we? And his move to the club didn't work out for one reason or the other. Probably wasn't due to his social media activity. But it's an interesting topic of discussion, that, because obviously when you look back at like Ben Rama's video, for example, and the suggestions that once he tweeted that and people saw him having his hair cut on holiday, you were thinking, not sure this is the kind of, you know, attitude or mentality that maybe they want him, because we're very much, or Leeds United is very much sort of built, this squad is currently very much built on the unity and togetherness and working for each other, not, you know. So it'd be interesting. I don't think, I mean, there is, it's one thing tweeting a video of your holiday, But I think it's another thing, sort of trying to basically force a move through, or force a move to at least move to the next stage where it basically becomes yes or no. So then he can potentially move on to either another club. So I suppose it's a difficult thing that they need to weigh up. But if you Leeds United, maybe you take it as a positive. He really wants to join.
Toying with defences, toying with hearts and minds as well, Rodrigo De Paul. So it's one to watch. Kvaratskhelia, the centre-back from Croatia, extremely highly rated, fairly expensive as well, from Zagreb, Croatia youth international. The last time we checked with Leeds United, they felt it was doable, but it wasn't imminent. And there was still some work to be done on that, and a decision on whether or not that's the route they want to take. You know, it's, if you're talking 20 million, that's a lot of money for a player who's, unless Cooper gets injured, he's probably not going to play this season, especially with Stroik, you know, in the picture as well. So he's very much one for the future, but he's also a player who, if you spend 20 million on now, there's a chance that you make that back and some if he turns out to be as good as everyone thinks he is.
Yeah, you do wonder Bielsa's thinking in terms of the centre-back options, and I think that's why it'll be interesting to see who plays against Hull as centre-half, whether he decides to try and improve that defensive partnership with Cock and whoever else it is, if Cooper's fit. I can't imagine Cooper will be risked for Wednesday or Stroik, but you know, you've still got Cresswell and Casey there. We've seen clips of Cresswell in training, and to be honest, he's been very impressive from what I've seen. Obviously, the Premier League and everything that brings is completely different step and huge step. But if he thinks they can come in and do a job for the odd game, etc., then, like you said, it's 20 million for a player that is a development player, essentially, and a fringe player. Is that how much you want to spend if you're talking about needing an extra 10 million to potentially get De Paul in? So I think that's probably why there's a lot of different cogs going round at Ellen Road at the moment, trying to figure out where they want to get their ducks in a row, so to speak, to figure out how they want to shape their squad this year. And ultimately, as everything else in Leeds United at this current moment in time, it should come down to whether Bielsa wants the player or not. So, remains to be seen.
Yeah, it's gone very quiet on Ryan Kent after that initial bid was knocked back. And they do very much seem to be biding their time and considering what their next move is going to be. That's Ryan Kent, who's the SPL Player of the Month and is on fire at the minute. Just FYI. And of course, you've got young Jimmy expected to come in this week from Feyenoord. Crescencio Somerville, who another, you know, you say it almost every single time a young player joins a club, you know, highly rated, but people do speak very highly of him, and he has a little bit of first-team experience while he was out on loan last season. And that one is expected to happen, a winger. So they're beefing up the 23s options. They're building for the future. Some of these players as well, I don't think there's ever going to be a player that Leeds bring in simply because they think we can sell him in 12 months' time and double our money. I think they're all brought in with footballing reasons behind the signings, but there will definitely be part of the thinking that involves saleability in the future and how much these players are going to rise in value. And they've done quite a bit of significant recruitment for the 23s and for the future, but they still have work to do for the first team. We were told last week by agents and by the club that they're expecting some late transfer window action all over the place that will kind of spark a domino effect with players moving here, there and everywhere. It has been a fairly slow and stagnant market, I guess financially as well. Clubs are having to take stock because if we don't get fans back in stadiums, it is a significant factor financially, even if you're a Premier League club. Yes, you know, Leeds have increased their TV money to the power of 10, but the amount of money that Leeds were bringing in on a match day was significant in their revenue streams last year. It would have been even more significant this season. And whilst they're not quite at the levels of Tottenham's or maybe Manchester United's in terms of taking money off people on a match day, it's still a lot of money. And it's a big gap in your revenue. they'll have sold an awful lot of kits, an awful lot of training gear, and they've made a significant amount of money that way. But COVID is still making a big dent in club finances all over the sport. And so maybe that's going to be a factor as well with teams and their expenditure. You know, can we get away with spending a bit less than we might otherwise have to? You know, and I know certainly at lower league level that there are clubs who previously would have taken a player because he was available and because they liked him, and who are saying no to that player because all they're focusing on is their priority positions. You know, we need a right back and a centre forward. This centre midfielder that we've tracked for the last 2 years is suddenly available. Do we want to take him? Probably not right now, because we'd need a right back and a striker, and that's it. There's not really a lot of superfluous spending going on. So again, it'll be interesting to see if that has an impact on Leeds United's transfer dealings between now and the end of the window. We know there's a budget there still for further spending. Radrizzani has made that clear. They will, I'm certain, still bring in at least one, probably two, signings for the first team. But who those signings will be, still very much up in the air.
Yeah, I think it's interesting we talk about the impact or the financial impact of the pandemic, because it's not just, you know, so we talk about Leeds United and the impact that it's hitting Elland Road, because they're not selling pints of beer, pies, etc., etc., selling the merchandise on match days. But also, you think about like the local businesses just outside as well, in the pubs that aren't taking match day revenue, the fish and chip shops and everything. So it's local economy as well around Elland Road that's been hit tremendously, because I imagine that, I mean, I went to Gravely's just before the pandemic hit, not for fish and chips, to actually talk to the owner. But then they gave me some free fish and chips, which was a very nice. But, you know, they basically take 75% of their earnings from match day, you know, match days on Leeds United. So it's going to be interesting to see how long the football clubs and the local economies around football club stadiums, et cetera, et cetera. And then obviously when you open it up to the wider world, how financially stable the whole thing's going to be. It's because I think even Richard Masters was talking about it last week, about that the Premier League is not immune from this. You know, they need bums on seats, and hopefully, if it's safe to do so in the next few months, people can start returning at lower capacity. In the near future, obviously, test events are planned, etc. So fingers crossed, because it's something that I think, like, again, we go back to Bielsa being misquoted when he meant in its purest of form when he said Anfield isn't Anfield without supporters. Obviously, some people blew that out of proportion by saying, like, we don't hold any fear to Anfield. But what he meant was that without the supporters, the soul of the stadium isn't there, and it's exactly the same. Any stadium you go to without any fans in is sort of quite sad at the moment. Obviously, it's the way of the world, but hopefully we can slowly begin to return to a state where supporters can be back in the ground, because, like we saw at the weekend, a 4-3 with Liverpool was great, but without the added atmosphere, didn't quite have everything.
No. And there are myriad reasons for sticking to the social distancing guidelines and the rules at the minute. But wouldn't it be nice if everyone just behaved themselves and we were able to get fans back in stadiums sooner rather than later? Because you're right, it's not, football's not nothing without the fans. It's still something, because there's still enjoyment to be gleaned from it, if only through the television or the laptop. But it's a pale imitation of its former self. Elland Road in particular, without fans, is it's a sobering place. It's quite hard to get revved up for a game and quite hard to get into that mindset, oh, a football game's about to take place. So the sooner the fans are back in, the better. Next up is Hull City. They've started the season fairly well in League One, not the Championship. They still have Grant McCann in place.
It's the Louis Coyle derby.
The Louis Coyle derby. So, in terms of what to expect from them, who knows? I mean, they'll see. I don't think they can afford to take this game as a game in which they give minutes to players who haven't played. I know that the promotion from League One is probably their aim this season, but I think it would be detrimental to their season and to morale around the club that is probably already still suffering, given what happened last season, if they came to Leeds and played a weaker side and got battered. So I would expect they'll still be as strong a side as Grant McCann can muster, with the likes of McGuinness playing up front. What they've got to avoid is a kind of shoeing that they got towards the end of last season, you know, when Leeds started that run that they went on. When it all started with that game against Hull, when they just played some sensational football, some of the same football that they played against Anfield, actually, which was a nice little moment to show that it worked. If it works against Hull, it can work against Liverpool, and a good idea is a good idea. So, yeah, interesting encounter ahead in the Carabao Cup, and then it's on to Fulham and Scott Parker. Let's have your predictions, Joe, for firstly Hull and then for Fulham.
I expect Leeds to go through. Obviously, it'll be interesting to see the squad, but I'll go 3-0 Leeds United.
I'm going to say 3-1 Leeds United, and then for Fulham?
It's tricky, isn't it? Because they haven't played each other just last season. It'll be interesting to see if the game develops in the same way. Obviously, not quite the same promotion ambitions on the line, and whether how Fulham approach the game. Do they approach it similar to how they did in the Championship? I still think Leeds should have enough, and I hope they will do. So I'll go 2-0 Leeds.
I was going to say 2-0 Leeds, so I'll say 2-1. I'll say 2-1. I'll say 3-1 against Hull. I'll say 2-1 against Fulham.
Although I've just gone for two clean sheets, and then having watched Leeds United's defensive performance at Liverpool at the weekend. But it's a bold strategy. Let's hope it pays off.
Excellent. Right. That's all from episode 91 of the Inside Elland Road podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back probably next year.